This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
Welcome to the Agency in Focus, NASA, sponsored by Leidos. Now, here's your host, Tom Temin.
Harrison Schmitt may not be a household name like John Glenn or Neil Armstrong, but this early astronaut both went to the moon and was elected to the Senate. He's still active in NASA affairs more than 50 years after being selected for the astronaut program back in 1965. In part one of my interview, Schmitt describes what it was like to become an astronaut, but coming from the scientific world and not from the flyboys.
Well, there were mixed feelings within NASA, as I find out later, about whether or not you needed to have people who are specialists in certain fields preparing to go into space versus training the pilot community already there to try to understand enough of about a particular discipline that they could perform the task that they were asked to perform. But I think that once the six scientists who were selected first were in the program, that started to fade, not rapidly, but it started to fade, that attitude within NASA, and that we really became a major and integral part of the program. There were people in NASA right from early on, and certainly people outside within the National Academy of Sciences and the U.S. Geological Survey and elsewhere who pushed very hard to have scientists in the program. And they obviously eventually won out so that the Group 4 selection was of scientists and engineers who did not have the kind of the level of pilot training that the original three groups of astronauts had. And that for that reason, and I think a very, very important other reason, so we went to Air Force pilot training and then to Navy helicopter training. Now, everybody went to Navy helicopter training. None of the pilots were helicopter pilots either. And so everybody went through that training.
And in retrospect, the pilot training, do you feel that it actually helped? Because let's face it, in a space capsule that is launched from a rocket and returns with a heat shield, there's really no planar surfaces to be manipulated aerodynamically the way there might be in a fighter jet.
Well, yes. That the aerodynamic side of it, of course, was a pathway to doing other things. Part of it was becoming part of that community of pilots. That was very important to join in that culture. Another part was to learn psychologically how to put your faith in a machine. That's what an airplane is, and that's what a spacecraft is. And the more of those kinds of machines that you train to fly, the better you're going to be at the next one. The helicopter training was originally put into the program for familiarization with vertical landing and with hand-eye coordination that was going to be required in the lunar module. And as the next step from helicopters to flying the lunar module, there was this lunar landing training vehicle, the LLTV, that had been developed out at Dryden Space Center in California and was brought to Ellington Air Force Base for training of both the commanders and the lunar module pilots. Unfortunately, that vehicle proved to be so difficult to fly that it was decided that the lunar module pilots would not check out in that LLTV, but it would only involve the commanders who were going to fly the lunar module directly anyway. The lunar module pilot was more of a systems engineer and a co-pilot, although on my side of the spacecraft, I had all the controls that the commander did. The way the duties were separated was really very different. And so I never checked out in the LLTV, but the helicopter training initially was related to that, although, again, I feel very strongly that it assisted me in learning how to perform my duties, particularly so-called abort duties, in the lunar module.
Yeah, I guess some of those skills you learn in that training you may not use hour by hour or minute by minute, but in an emergency situation, I guess they would save your life.
Yeah, and we practice those emergency situations a great deal.
Sure, and you did end up spending, according to your bio, 2,100 hours flying, 16 in jet aircraft, so it wasn't all for nothing.
I enjoyed the pilot aspect of things very, very much. I think it was a very important part of my training for Apollo, and in fact, I've continued to recommend to NASA that all astronauts be checked out as pilots. And they are moving more in that direction again now, as I understand it, although I'm not familiar with the current program.
Okay, well, let's move on to, you went to the moon. You've probably been asked this 10,000 times, but I've never spoken to anyone who's, well, I did speak to Buzz Aldrin once, a long time ago, but not in this type of situation. Describe that for us.
Well, you don't have enough time, I don't think.
Well, yeah, give us the two-minute version anyway.
Yeah, well, it was a remarkable opportunity and privilege to participate in Apollo and to be the 12th person to step on the moon. And actually the only scientist. By the time the last three or four missions were planned, we knew pretty much how to do the job, obviously. The risks were still there, but we knew that we could handle those risks pretty much, and that we could concentrate on the exploration side of being on the moon. And that was really the primary function that I had and the primary reason that I was on the mission. I was perfectly capable of flying, but also I brought the expertise of a geologist to the last mission, and also to the training of the astronauts on previous missions.
And when you were there, what types of geological things did you do? What was your job on the moon, so to speak?
Well, we had photography that had been taken both by an unmanned spacecraft called the Lunar Orbiter many years before, and also over our landing site, we had photographs taken by the Apollo 15 mission cameras. But still, the resolution of those photographs was no better than about 15 meters, the identifying resolution, if you will. But using those, we planned out three excursions, three what we called extravehicular activity periods, EVAs. And the plan was, of course, to implement that set of traverses, recognizing that depending on what you saw, once you were there, that you might modify those plans. And it was up to me to try to guide any modifications that we might want to make based on what we learned. It turned out that the plan was pretty good. And our discoveries were all within that resolution limit that had been imposed on us by the previous photography.
But it sounds like NASA training includes a certain amount of, I guess, mental and operational agility to go along with you up there.
Well, it does, but it's not so much the NASA training. It's your previous professional training. And again, pilots have that with respect to flying spacecraft, and geologists have that with respect to exploration. And it, I think, proves the point that if you have a specialized job to do, you take somebody who's a professional to do that job rather than trying to train some non-professional to do it. It's just a lot more efficient to work that way.
And Neil Armstrong was famously reticent about whatever reaction he might have had personally to standing on the moon. And what was yours? And did he ever share his with you? Not that you need to tell us what he said, but is that part of the recollections of people that have done this?
Well, it wouldn't be up to me to speak to Neil at all. He obviously felt, I think as I do, that he had a great privilege and it was a great honor to participate. And he did a magnificent job, actually, in the short time that he had on the moon with respect to sample collection. His suite of samples is one of the best that we have for the amount of time that he had to collect them. And particular one particular sample is particularly important in identifying the resources that exist on the moon that can be used not only in space and for future lunar settlements, but also a particular resource called helium-3 that is a it comes from the sun and is embedded in the lunar materials, the lunar debris layer. And it is ideal fuel for fusion power reactors. And someday, I suspect, we'll be using that lunar fuel down here on Earth. So Neil did an outstanding job, but you have to try to search out his own personal recollections. Mine were just that it was a magnificent place to be, an exciting place for a geologist to be. The valley we were in, the Valley of Carso-Littoro, is one that's deeper than the Grand Canyon, as a matter of fact. The mountains on either side go to 6,000 and 7,000 feet above the valley floor. It is brilliantly illuminated, at least while we were there, by the sun. But the hardest thing for me to get used to visually was the black sky. The sky is absolutely black, of course. And that is something that I never really got fully used to. It was in the back of my mind all the time to be in this magnificent place. But the pressure that I felt to use the time I had there, those 21 hours, as efficiently as possible was very strong. And so I stored away my visual and emotional reactions to being there pretty much. I think some of the other astronauts have done the same thing, but many of them, I think, were much more surprised at being there than I was.
Former astronaut Harrison Schmitt. In part two of my interview, Schmitt says why NASA needs to sharpen its focus if it plans on actually getting back to the moon, much less Mars. I'm Tom Temin.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
Between Mars, the Moon, the space station, orbiting telescopes and probes from the Sun to Pluto, NASA has a lot of missions, maybe too many. In part two of my interview, former astronaut Harrison Schmitt, who's still an active geologist and professor, says the agency needs to sharpen its focus if it hopes to get people back into deep space. But first, he describes his photographic assignment while on the Moon.
I'm still very active in the lunar science field. And I use them all the time, writing papers and stuff like that. And all the documentation that those photographs gives us is something that continues to surprise me. We had excellent film, a brand new type of Kodak film called Ektachrome 360 that I was a little bit suspicious of originally because I didn't like Ektachrome here on Earth, the early version. But this turned out to be a magnificent film base. It has been preserved very well. One of the things NASA has done quite well through over 45 years is to protect that film by refrigeration. It's being digitized by a group I know very well at the Arizona State University. Those digital images are as good as the original images that I saw 45 years ago.
I was going to say they might have chosen Ektachrome because they could develop it themselves, unlike Kodachrome, which I always preferred also.
Well, this Ektachrome was excellent, and it was a positive film. I looked at the images right after I came back, went through it with a 10-power hand lens, and could see extraordinary detail in them then, and I still can see that in the digitized images that we have today. And also, there's data in those films that you can bring out color information, for example, that isn't obvious in the picture as they've been printed by NASA, but in the digitized version, you can work and get that color information and enhance some of the things that I described verbally, like the orange soil that I found. That that doesn't come out nearly as strongly in the photographs as it does in my mind and by and from my descriptions. And we've recently been able to enhance these photographs so that that color is much more like what I actually saw.
It sounds like the visual images, the black sky, the orange soil, did make an indelible impression on your mind, though.
Well, no question about it. And, you know, unless you start to lose those memories, well, they will always be there.
Former astronaut Harrison Schmitt. I'm Tom Tamman.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
Former astronaut Harrison Schmitt. And talk about NASA as an organization at that point. I mean, when you were chosen in 1965, it was only a couple of years, you know, since John Glenn had launched. And they were still, it was still seemed a little raw compared to the organization that we have today. What did it seem like in NASA in those days?
Well, I would reverse that. I think the NASA that developed, particularly after the fire at the Cape that we had in 1967, the NASA that developed and that accomplished the Apollo missions was a much more professional and energetic NASA than you have today. It was younger by a long shot, by a factor of two about. The average age of most of the engineers and skilled workers, some 400,000 of them in NASA and in the industry, most of them in the industry, the average age was in the 20s. They were extraordinarily diligent, patriotic. Their stamina was unbelievable. And it's what really, I think, made the whole thing possible were these young men, mostly. They NASA today is much older than that and much more bureaucratic. And I think that if you're going to implement the president's new initiative, directive to return to the moon and go on to Mars, NASA is going to have to be reorganized more along the lines that we had at Apollo than it is today.
Because it's got many, many more missions, perhaps, than it did now, many more lines of technology. Is that part of the problem?
Well, part of it, it's been given many responsibilities that are outside the particular responsibility of getting back to the moon and going on to Mars. And I think you need to shed some of those other responsibilities. There are other agencies that can take those on if the Congress and the administration decide that they're important to continue. But if you really believe geopolitically as well as humanistically that we should return to the moon and settle that planet and also go on to Mars, then NASA is going to have to focus on that mission and not on all these other extraneous things.
Because when you joined the agency in the 70s, you were, in a sense, a part of that spreading out of what NASA does. You were the assistant.
Not really. We were very much an agency focused on accomplishing the goal that Eisenhower and Kennedy had set for us. And that that really was the number one priority. There was a small aeronautics activity that was inherited from the precursors of NASA, the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics. And there were a few people thinking about some future projects, but really NASA was focused on going to the moon and returning safely to Earth. That was the job to be done, and that's what everybody had signed up to do.
But in 1974, as Assistant Administrator for Energy Programs, tell us about what you did at that point.
Well, that was something that I was asked to do by George Lowe and Jim Fletcher, and to come and see if NASA's technologies, how NASA's technologies could be adapted to help other agencies with their energy missions. You may know that in that period of time, there was a great emphasis on energy technology and its development and dealing with our dependence on fossil fuels coming from abroad. Now we have our own supplies of fossil fuels, so that dependency doesn't exist like it did then. And so as part of that national energy policy effort, I tried to put together a system by which NASA's various energy production and energy conversion technologies could be used by other agencies. And it went fairly well for a couple of years. And then I had decided prior to that that I would get into politics and run for the United States Senate. And that effort eventually died off within NASA. It was never properly funded by the OMB, and so it couldn't really do a lot of what we thought it could at the time.
And tell us about your life post-Senate. You've really had done everything at that point, a distinguished career in geology, somewhat in energy. You'd been to the moon, and you'd been to the Senate.
Well, I've been mainly involved in business activities and scientific activities since then. I published a book on lunar resources, and I'm in the process of publishing now, going back and publishing a diary of the Apollo 17 mission. That's going online. I've been a director of the Orbital Sciences Corporation, and then the last 3 years it was called the Orbital ATK Corporation. That has just been acquired by Northrop Grumman, so that business is gone. But since 1983, I was an active director of those two organizations, and a director of a number of other companies at various times. So I've stayed very active in business and very active in my scientific activities.
Now, President George H.W. Bush did skydiving until just very recently, just a couple of years ago. And John Glenn famously orbited late in life. You are now 83. If they asked you, would you take another flight and maybe hop onto the moon one more time?
Oh, I would love to do that. My wife would like to go along, I know. And it would be a great opportunity. But I don't expect that offer to come over the transom, as they say.
No, and you don't want to be like Henny Youngman. I went on a pleasure trip. I took my wife to NASA so I could send her on a trip to the moon. Former astronaut Harrison Schmitt. There's much more to the interview. Find it in its entirety at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency of the Month. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Agency in Focus NASA, sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.